This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Native Americans have had voting rights in federal elections for nearly a century, but an indigenous woman had never won a seat in Congress until last year.
The time for people to not be heard and not be seen and not be listened to or represented well changes now.
That was Kansas Representative Charisse Davids during her victory speech in November. In the midterm, she and New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland became the first two Native American women in Congress. Female tribal citizens broke ground in many state positions as well, including Peggy Flanagan, who's the new lieutenant governor of Minnesota.
I want every young person in Minnesota tonight to know, black, white, brown, or indigenous, that you can grow up and you can lead this state.
But as Flanagan said on the campaign trail, Native women are at best invisible and at worst, disposable. Indigenous peoples as a whole don't fare much better. But today, we're bringing together Native American women who are settling into their new positions of power as part of our special project 1A Across America. Joining us from the U.S. Capitol is Kansas Representative Charisse Davids. She is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Congresswoman Davids, welcome to 1A.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Joining us from Minnesota Public Radio is Minnesota's Lieutenant Governor, Peggy Flanagan. She is the highest-ranking Native American woman in a state executive position, and she is a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us here in studio is Mark Trahant. He's the editor of Indian Country Today. Mark, thanks for being here.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Congresswoman Davids, let me start with you. How have your first 150 or so days been going? How did your expectation of what Congress would be like compare to reality?
Well, I'm not sure I had too much of an expectation, except that I knew that we were going to be on a steep learning curve. And so that expectation has been met for sure. One of the things, because of the topic that we're touching on today, that I want to mention is that I'm often telling people that I don't know what this experience would be like if Representative Deb Haaland wasn't also here at the same time that I am, both of us coming in as freshman members of Congress and, you know, making our way through this very long-standing institution and figuring out how we can best use our voice and our lived experience to really add to the conversation. As the sole member of the Kansas delegation that is part of the Democratic majority in the House, I definitely think that there are a few things I bring, you know, whether it's the voice of the Kansas 3rd District or the voice of a Native woman who has some previous experience and expertise in federal Indian law and economic and community development in Native communities. I think that, you know, the idea of this Congress accepting, embracing, and a lot of times highlighting some of the work that both Deb Haaland and I are doing has been pretty phenomenal.
And Congresswoman Davids, can you tell us a little bit about the 3rd District? Where exactly is that? What's the demographic like? Just paint us a basic picture.
Oh, I'd love to talk about the Kansas 3rd District. So we're the Kansas City metro area. We're on the Kansas side. So Kansas City, Kansas, which is in Wyandotte County, is its own unique historical place in this country. Wyandotte County is one of the full counties that's in the district. The other one is Johnson County, which has a lot of suburban parts of the KC metro area. And then we have a small portion of Miami County where it starts to be a little more rural. And the district has, you know, I mean, I graduated from a community college there. We've got one of the best community colleges in the country right there. But we've got just this, I'd say, strong emphasis on public education, which is, you know, a huge part of why I've had the opportunities I've had in my life. And I was really excited that Kansas got to play a role this year in being part of this history-making class of freshman members of Congress.
Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, let me come to you. Similar first question. What have you learned about being a state executive in Minnesota in your first few days in office?
Well, as Representative David said, it is a steep learning curve. But I think that what I have really learned is the responsibility, the weight of the responsibility, and the overwhelming feeling of being in the room where it happens. I think that's the difference that it makes having Indigenous women, Native people at the decision-making table. The outcomes that we're able to achieve, I think, are more reflective of who lives in the state as a whole. And just, I think we get better policy outcomes when our government accurately represents, or more accurately represents, the folks who live here. So that has been what has been really powerful for me.
Yeah, would you
first few months.
Would you expand on that, please, in terms of who lives in Minnesota? Because the state, I think some people would be surprised to know, is remarkably diverse. There's a significant Hmong population there. There's a significant population from various, you know, countries with a large Muslim population. Talk about the indigenous populations in Minnesota and what some of their unique needs and concerns are.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for knowing about the great state of Minnesota and that we have a really diverse population here, of course. Of, as you mentioned, the Hmong community, we have a significant Somali population. Our Latinx community is large as well, African-American. And the Native population, we've got 11 reservations in the state of Minnesota, as well as a significant urban American Indian population, too. And I think, you know, the needs of our communities are vast, but it comes down to issues around education, healthcare, issues surrounding community prosperity, and really the need to ensure, and I think the role of the state is that we are playing a real role in ensuring that government-to-government relationships with our tribal nations are strengthened and adhered to. So we just finished our first legislative session where we had some pretty significant victories in Indian country around passing a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force, additional funding for BIE schools or Bureau of Indian Education schools here, and essentially incorporated culturally relevant policymaking into the work that we did through the Department of Human Services. And I think that the difference is we're just making sure that people who are directly impacted by the kind of policies we're passing or by the budget that we're building are the people who are at the table making decisions right along with us.
Mark Trahant, let me come to you, and I'm remiss in not mentioning earlier that you are a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe. Sorry, I should have said that earlier.
That's fine.
We are talking now about Native American women during this past election. How much progress have Native American men made in politics before now?
Well, Native American men have a lot longer history of being elected to office, so this is where the real push. This was the first campaign season where there were more Native women running than men across the country. And more than 30 got elected to legislators and to Congress, of course, and to state executive office. So it was really remarkable in that sense. Men were first elected starting in the 1800s in small numbers. And in either group, whether it's men or women, we're still far behind population parity in terms of elective office.
You mean in terms of the percentage of people in a particular region or district or state who are indigenous and whether that matches their representation in the government that sets laws for them?
Correct. We're now at 2/3 of 1% in the Congress.
Now, we spoke with Congresswoman Deb Haaland last October. She was mentioned earlier from New Mexico. We spoke to her when she was a candidate at the time. Here is what she told us at the time in terms of the important issues for Native voters.
Tribal communities always, always care tremendously about our education system. And so that's something that is high on my list as well as health care, right? We half of our population here in New Mexico is Medicaid eligible. That includes the 22 tribal communities that we have here in the state. And so that's always an important issue as well.
That's Deb Haaland of New Mexico during her campaign for Congress, speaking to us last October. Mark, she mentioned education, healthcare, Medicaid. Both Lieutenant Governor Flanagan and Congresswoman Davids both mentioned education. Are there to be very broad about it, Native American issues, or are there just issues that Native Americans tend to get ignored on?
Both. this is the short answer. This is an example, though, I think, of where Representative Holland has just been brilliant. For years and years, members of Congress have rallied around the Indian Health Service and talked about full funding for Indian Health Service, which has never happened. But if you look at the actual data, Medicaid is far more a bigger part of the picture than the IHS budget itself. And yet nobody's gone in and said, this is connected and these two things have to happen together. And that's where the statement by Representative Holland was so effective.
Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, something you said on the campaign trail caught our attention. You said, quote, "Too often our Native women are at best invisible and at worst disposable," unquote. Talk a little bit more about the plight of Native American women in Minnesota as you see it, and what are you working to have done about that?
Well, I think when, you know, I made a statement like that, and I continue to make that statement because it is changing, but I think it's still accurate. It does come back to education, which we have all talked about. I think there are too many people in Minnesota and across the country who don't actually even know that Native people still exist as contemporary people. The images that we are bombarded with every single day, the Washington football team, Chief Wahoo, even advertisements that we see, Halloween costumes of Pocahontas, that, you know, the over-sexualization of Native American women. These are the kind of images that we see in popular culture. So the sort of view that people oftentimes have of Native women is skewed. And I meet people, even in Minnesota, who don't know that Native American people still exist. So that is why I think when you erase an entire group of people, it devastates us, but also means that then you don't have to actually pay attention to how we're investing in these communities, how we're working in partnership with them to pass public policy that improves people's lives. And so, you know, erasure has really devastating consequences for American Indian people. So part of the reason that I even decided to run for lieutenant governor, right, because it's certainly every little girl's dream to be the second most powerful person in the state, right? but the reason, one of the reasons I did clearly was to be there with a really strong partner and ally in Governor Tim Walz. But also after we had the tragic death here in the Midwest of Savannah Graywind, who is a young Native woman who was pregnant and had her baby ripped from her womb, and she was left to die, disposed of in a river. This is a story.
She had her baby ripped from her what?
Ripped from her womb by a neighbor. They stole her baby and they left her to die. And this is a story, and Joshua, your reaction sort of proves my point, only in that everyone in Indian country knows this story, everybody. But national media, frankly, didn't pick it up in the way that they should have. And so this is the danger, frankly, of being a Native woman. We simply disappear. So, I think having Charisse and Deb and Paulette Jordan, who ran for governor of Idaho, and serving in this position, it increases the visibility of Indigenous women, and I think also means that people are going to need to really grapple with these issues. Native women have been leaders since time immemorial. That's not new. But it is new that, you know, our national popular culture is starting to catch up, frankly, with where Native communities have been for generations.
Well, Congresswoman Davids, I want to carry on with that. And there are other issues I want to talk to everyone about, but I don't want us to glaze over this one. We got a voicemail from a listener. Nicole in New Hampshire left this in our inbox.
I'm a state representative in New Hampshire, and I'm one of the few younger state reps. And having a political role model to me is very important in the way that I have someone to look for how to act and how to conduct myself in my state and what I can bring to the table. And I feel like role models in the political sector are few and far between.
Yeah, Nicole, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Congresswoman Davids, before we pause, I'd love your reaction to that, particularly because you presided over the House during a vote on missing and murdered Indigenous women legislation. Talk about that role model role in the House, even if it's just related to generating awareness that this is even happening.
Yeah, so, I would say first my response to the voicemail is those are the kinds of messages that when I get them, it's a little bit emotionally overwhelming, because I think that sometimes in our day-to-day, and, you know, I don't know if the lieutenant governor feels this as well, but in our day-to-day, we're really doing a lot of hard work. And I think that the impact that that's having, the ripple effects of the work that we're doing, we often don't see that or hear that, and so it's a very powerful thing for folks to let us know that, because you know, we really are doing this because in the generations to come, we're the first to serve in these positions, but we certainly aren't the last, and we know that because folks are letting us know. So I did get to preside over the House floor when the Violence Against Women Act was reauthorized, mm-hmm. and it contained things that address the issues with Indigenous women and girls, and including you know, addressing the missing and murdered Indigenous women.
Congresswoman, I hate to interrupt you. We're up against a break. I promise I'll come right back to you and let you finish your thought and tell us more about that legislation when we come back. We got to pause, and then we'll get to some more of your thoughts as well. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Babbel. Have you always wanted to speak a new language? Whether it's for travel, work, or brain training, Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons will get you speaking confidently in your new language. Choose from Spanish, French, and more. You'll learn through real-life dialogues, speech recognition, and interactive trainers. And Babbel's spaced repetition method actually makes you remember what you've learned. Download the app or go to Babbel, Babbel.com, to try Babbel for free.
A language was about to die.
Once it gets wiped out, that's it. We will have nothing in our language to pass to our children.
And the people trying to save it were still learning how to speak it.
And we had to hurry up. Time was working against us. We were like 100 years late, you know?
It's Code Switch. Listen and subscribe.
Back now to our conversation about the rise of Native American women in American politics as part of our special project 1A Across America. Congresswoman, sorry I had to cut you off before. Let me let you finish your thought, and then I'll let Mark chime in.
Right. No worries. I am trying to keep this concise here. One of the things that I wanted to mention was, you know, the way the Violence Against Women Act addresses some of the issues around missing and murdered Indigenous women is by allowing an information sharing and coordination between law enforcement agencies. And I think that a lot of times what people don't realize is that there are some barriers that exist to tribal law enforcement and then state law enforcement and sometimes federal folks from actually being able to help address finding women when they go missing. And so that's some of what the Violence Against Women Act is going to do. But I wanted to touch on what the lieutenant governor brought up about Savannah Graywind. And there's two things that we're working on here. Savannah's Act, which is named after Savannah Graywind because it was such a huge, impactful and devastating thing for us to see with the long history of Native women going missing, but also to have one of our children being removed from, you know, potentially being removed from our tribal structures, our communities, and that is something that we've seen for a long time as well. And then the Not Invisible Act, which addresses really just trying to figure out how we make sure that everybody's working together to identify and combat the violent crimes that are happening in Indian country and Native communities, because a lot of times we know that there's a problem, and it feels sometimes like we're running around waving our arms saying, we need people to pay attention to this.
Yeah.
And we now have people who are sitting in these various, whether it's state houses, the Congress, who are saying, we're not here to tell you what the problems are. We're here to educate you, but we're also here to listen, to make, because it is not that people haven't had a voice for a very long time. They have. Native communities, Native women have had a voice for a long time and have been in leadership positions.
Right.
Decision makers in Washington, D.C. and state houses have not been listening. And we now have people who are saying we need to listen to what's going on so that we can help address these issues.
Mark?
Well, one of the great things about being at Indian Country Today is we can sit back and kind of look at the entire country. And with this wave of Native women who were elected to legislators, the first thing they did was to act on missing and murdered Indigenous women across the country. You're seeing legislation signed in Minnesota, in Arizona, North Dakota, Montana, Alaska, where folks have taken this is important and we're now in a position to do something about it. And here's our plan.
Let me ask you a little bit more about your backgrounds. Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, how did you make your way into politics? Is there anything in your background that would have hinted at you eventually being where you are today, or does this come as a surprise to even you?
Well, I was ready to be an early childhood special education teacher. I majored in child psychology and American Indian Studies at the great University of Minnesota. But then during my senior year of college, I volunteered for the Wellstone for Senate campaign. And everything changed. And at no point did I think I was going to run for statewide office. But I knew that it was critically important to ensure that Native people were engaged in politics, were voting, and eventually running for office. So I spent much of my career, and it was the first time that I actually was able to work with Mark a bit, when I led the Native American Leadership Program at Wellstone Action, where we trained Native folks how to run for office, work on issues that were important in their communities. And I think so much of the work, I'm going to give just a little love to Mark and all the work that he's done on Native Vote really set us up to be in a position in 2018. So much of that is because he laid the groundwork with the stories that he told of highlighting the work that was happening. And, you know, for a long time, Native people were voting in elections, but the logical next step, I think, is for us to run for office. So what happened in 2018 was really important. And I think it's not just a blip in time. It is the foundation on which we build, as Congresswoman Davis just said, of clearing a path and holding the door open for the folks who are going to come after us. But I got bit by the bug by working for the late, great Senator Paul Wellstone and served on the Minneapolis School Board and then in the State House of Representatives. And that's the pathway that led me here. But my background's in nonprofit work, and so I like to just remind people that it takes folks of all different kinds of backgrounds and experience to serve in office to make sure that we've got a diverse group of voices who are helping us to make good decisions for our communities.
We are speaking to Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan of Minnesota, Congresswoman Charisse Davids, a Democrat representing Kansas, and Mark Trahant, the editor of Indian Country Today. We'll have more with them in just a moment. Stay close.
Support also comes from NCR. Let's face it, as a small business owner, you wear so many hats every day, you rarely have time to focus on activities that drive profitability or bring in new customers. That's why you need a point of sale that does more. NCR Silver delivers simple to understand analysis and business building tools like email marketing and loyalty, so you can get back to focusing on your customers. NCR Silver. Visit ncr.com/silver.
I'm Gregory Warner. On Rough Translation, we follow a rescue mission in real time after an Iraqi photojournalist goes missing on the front lines.
We don't believe it. I don't believe it.
He leaves his family and his friends to try to save him.
When he said, "Who is this?" or like, "Who are you?" they respond, "We are the Islamic State."
From NPR's Rough Translation, listen and subscribe.
Back now to our conversation on Native Americans and representation in government. Congresswoman Davids, let me get into your background. For one thing, you have experience as a mixed martial artist, which I think is amazing. I think that's very, very cool. We also got a question about your background from Amber, who asked on our Facebook page, when you began contemplating your race, meaning your political campaign, what were your thoughts on how to deal with people who might use your orientation against you? Did you feel the need to defend yourself at any time? I'm asking as an out and proud LGBTQ person in rural America with plans to run for office very soon. Congresswoman?
Well, I'm run. You should, everybody, I think I always say to anybody who is considering running, do it. So, no, I didn't. I'll back up really quickly because I feel like I always have to give all the due respect and acknowledgement that my mom, who raised my brothers and I by herself, she was in the Army for 20 years and really worked so hard to make sure that I could do whatever it was I wanted to do and thrive. She really laid a strong foundation. She also laid a strong foundation for me to really live my life in an authentic way and just be who I am. I never felt as though I needed to, I don't feel like I need to defend my existence to anybody on any piece of who I am, whether it's being a woman or being an out lesbian, part of the LGBTQ community, being a Native American person. And in politics, sometimes it's coming from a family that doesn't have a bunch of money. And it's coming from what I consider to be a very ordinary, like common experience, being a first generation college student. I went to community college. It took me 4 years to get an associate's degree, another 4 years to get a bachelor's degree because I was working the whole time. And I think a lot of people know what that experience is like. And it was not an experience that we've seen as much in politics as we should be seeing, not just the folks who are doing the hard work behind the scenes to get folks elected, but also the people who are putting their names on the ballot. And that is a lot of what I was thinking about when I was deciding whether I should run or not. And a lot of times I would see, you know, folks would worry about like, oh, well, you know, you don't have a large network of very wealthy people behind you.
Right.
Maybe you shouldn't run yet. And to me, that was like, no, that's absolutely the reason that I should be running. Because we need people who are sitting when the government shutdown was going on, when we saw members of the cabinet of this country telling people that they should go get loans when you don't have an income, that tells me we have people who are making decisions for folks and they have no idea of the implications of the impact on most of what we all have to deal with. We know we can't go get a loan if we don't have income. And the fact that we have people sitting in the cabinet who don't understand that, we've got a secretary who I am convinced of education, who I'm convinced did not set foot in a public school until she started trying to dismantle that system, that is not okay. And we need more people from broad, diverse, lived experiences to be getting on the ballots and getting elected.
I'm trying not to make a joke about being an MMA fighter and now being in Congress. I don't know any other way
it's
to ask
it. It's hard not to.
Yeah. So maybe I'll just let you briefly, like, is there any intersection there? I'm trying not to make a bad joke. I swear I'm trying not to make
a
bad joke.
Well, I'll say this. Running for office is similar to getting ready for a fight in that you have to consciously make the decision to step foot in either the gym or whatever other kind. You know, for the gym, you know you're going in, you're sparring, you're getting hit, you're getting punched in the face. But you got to learn from that experience. How do I improve for tomorrow? Running for office is not that dissimilar. You get punched in the face. It's just not physically. And you just got to figure out how do I do a better job tomorrow? And then you just keep working hard.
Before our time is up, Mark, I definitely wanted to talk about Native American voters. You've written about the increasing difficulties of Native Americans casting ballots as their votes get more influential. We talked not too long ago about a voter ID law in North Dakota. We talked about that right before the midterms. Here's a quick clip from that program with Carrie Levine, who's a reporter from the Center for Public Integrity.
The central issue here is that the law requires an ID that carries a residential street address. That's an issue because on many reservations, most people don't have that. They have P.O. boxes. They have mailing addresses. And those addresses are no longer sufficient. So if you have ID, but it carries a mailing address, like a post office box, you can no longer use it to vote in North Dakota in this election. You could in the primary when this law was stayed by the court, but that ID you used in the primary is no longer good for the general election.
Mark, I wonder how you see this progressing from here in terms of voter ID laws and other policies that many tribes have said make it harder for their citizens to be properly represented.
Well, let me zoom out and start with the big picture. Is we have some structural problems with voting in this country that we need to address, and that's part of it. Part of it's the way we draw districts. I mean, the most successful state in the country in terms of Native representation is Montana. Montana worked really hard at representation in districts, and it now has the highest percentage of Native Americans in the legislature. We need to do that across the country where people can think, how are we going to get the most effective proportional representation possible?
I know our time is short, but I do want to ask both Lieutenant Governor Flanagan and Congressman Davids what some of the big issues are that you want to focus on coming up. We've already talked about the murders of Indigenous women. Brittany asked on our Facebook page, as a Mohawk, I'm grateful that we finally have representation in the House. What do you plan to do to promote Native Nation sovereignty and treaty rights? As a public health professional and researcher, I'm also interested in how you will specifically advocate for Indigenous people's health. So treaty rights, Indigenous people's health. There is talk of whether there should be delegates from Indigenous peoples in Congress. There's a census coming up in 2020. What's kind of at the top of your radars going forward? Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, let me start with you and then Congresswoman Davids.
I mean, all of those things, right, are on our radar.
Anything at the top of the list?
One of the things that we did, the governor just signed Executive Order 1924 here in the state of Minnesota. And what that does is reaffirms Minnesota's commitment to government-to-government relationship, supporting treaty rights, tribal sovereignty, and requires every agency, commissioner, and leadership throughout our state agencies to go through tribal training to understand more about the Indigenous people who live here and the unique political status that we have. And incorporated in all of that is the need for tribal consultation and the requirement of every agency to do so and for the governor's office to do so. So we are, our goal is that when folks look at the state that's doing it right, the state that is working in partnership with our Native Nations, that it's Minnesota. So we have, signed this executive order, and now we need to make sure that it happens. And with relation to the census, we got to get our folks counted. It matters tremendously to Native people, especially with our relationship with the federal government. And then finally, I would just say, as was mentioned about healthcare, there are certainly Medicaid, as was just talked about, making sure that Indian Health Service is funded, but also here. And the state level, we need to make sure that we are delivering health care that is preventative and that is grounded in culture and culturally relevant for our people.
And before we go, Congresswoman, anything you would add to that list in our last few seconds?
Well, the health care, yes, but I also want to touch on transportation issues. I sit on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and I think that's a place where we can really see, we can infuse concepts of equity, but also making sure that we're, bringing in tribal voices into that process. Transportation impacts every single aspect of our lives, how we get to healthcare, how we get to school, how we get to our jobs. And so that's a place where I've been focusing a lot of energy too.
Democratic Kansas Congresswoman Charisse Davids from Kansas's 3rd District, a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Congresswoman, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks.
Peggy Flanagan, the Lieutenant Governor of Minnesota, a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today, a member of the Shoshone-Bannock Tribe. Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by James Morrison in collaboration with our 1A Across America partner stations, KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, and Minnesota Public Radio. It was edited by Miranda Fulmore. Special thanks to Minnesota Public Radio's Brianna Bierschbach and Jeff Jones. 1A Across America is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.